The Miro Quartet was established in 1995. Joshua and John, how did you all come together?
We were all students together at the Oberlin Conservatory in Ohio. Honestly, we formed the group to get credit for chamber music. Part of our degree in performance requires a certain number of credit hours in chamber music. So we formed the group with that intention. But we also formed because we all loved playing string quartets. It was a real commonality among the four of us and something that we all really loved doing and believed in. So the group was established, you know, out of love, but also out of necessity.
The name Miro, for those that don't know, comes from a famous Spanish artist whose work has been interpreted as surrealism. How does that relate to your music making?
You know, when we were at Oberlin and the group was forming within its first year, we decided to do a competition and we needed to name ourselves. And that's a really challenging thing. And we threw around some just awful, awful names, some just terrible. I was taking an art history class and I had just started to learn about Joan Miró, the Catalan artist. And I like that you said he was sort of categorized as surrealist because he spans so many different genres that he really, maybe even like Beethoven, was not really categorizable. But I read a quote, and he said that in order to be a great artist, you have to understand and imitate the past, be able to replicate the great masters. But when you sit down to create something personal, that you have to be soulful and honest about who you are as a human. The idea is that you're not imitating anything, but you're using that knowledge to inform your own creative process. And that was something that really spoke to me from a musical place. You know, as a musician, we have so many great quartets have recorded, the Beethoven string quartets, but nobody's recorded them like we have because it's very personal. And you know, we understand our history and our past, but you know, we have a great grasp of it, but we also have to be honest about who we are as musicians, and that informs our music making, and that's what makes live music and different groups different and so great.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Beethoven. You know, you sort of started out with Beethoven for many of your competitions. And as we've said, most string quartets perform Beethoven at some point. So there are so many interpretations out there. Can you go into a little bit more detail about what makes your performances so unique?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, we've been playing some of the Beethoven quartets since the very first years that we were together as young musicians. And from the very beginning, this idea of us recording all of the Beethoven quartets as we went through our lives as artists was something we all really felt strongly about. And living with these pieces over time, learning them all from the first to the last, seeing how the last quartet relates to the first quartet, and exploring them as four individuals, both on stage spontaneously, but also in the recording studio, really trying to dig into the scores and try to understand every detail of the pieces and really making them part of us, that's a big journey as artists. And it was something we really, from the beginning, really wanted to do. And I do feel like the four of us have found each of our own individual personalities reflected in these quartets. And yet when our different personalities come together in this music, we discover something brand new. And the Beethoven quartets never cease to challenge us and stimulate us, and also console and entertain and sometimes anger us because they're still difficult pieces no matter how long you play them.
So this group really took off. You've done a lot of recording, and it's not just Beethoven. Tell me a little bit about your recording history.
Yeah, we started very early on with some really unusual opportunities. Living in New York, we were given the opportunity to record some new music. We were approached to record the Black Angels by George Crumb, which is now one of the standard pieces in the literature, but he was our producer. It was a sort of a definitive recording, or at least that was the idea. But then we started to get kind of to our roots and the things that we really believed the strongest in, which was the core repertoire, Schubert, Beethoven, Dvorak, you know, the bread and butter of our repertoire. And more recently, we've been really lucky that we have a wonderful donor who covers the expense of recording for us, which is one of the things that's most difficult. Is it's expensive to record, and in the world of digital media and streaming, there's not a whole lot of money to be made in it. So we most recently have been able to offer our recordings back to the public for free. So right now, our Opus 131, our most recent album, is available on our website at miroquartet.com for free download until May 1st. And all of our other recordings can be streamed at any moment from there for free as well. And it's, you know, we've been given this incredible gift by this gentleman, and we believe so strongly in this music and feel that it needs to be heard and new versions of it need to be heard, that we're able to offer it back to people for free.
The Opus 131 Quartet is from the late quartet, some of the final works Beethoven composed. Can you give us some detail on this work and the recording that listeners can now download?
Yes. Well, I mean, this piece, like you mentioned, was written in the last year of Beethoven's life, and it was written actually during a time when he was struggling very, very much with his personal relationship with his adopted ward or foster son, who was his nephew, Carl. And within about a week of finishing his work on the score for this piece, 131, Carl was to attempt suicide. And you can hear the tension, the almost the feeling of struggling against fate in this piece, as well as some of the happy and peaceful music sort of has this dreamlike longing, perhaps longing for an ideal that never happened or a past that was very distant. And it's also a very personal and emotional work, I think, because of the struggles going on in Beethoven's life at the end of his life.
I understand it's your goal to release all of your Beethoven recordings, the complete cycle, in time for your 25th anniversary season and Beethoven's 250th birthday.
That's right. That's the year 2020, Beethoven's 250th anniversary and our 25th anniversary. And it's actually been a goal to get them all done in time. We have only two more to record after this 131, and we'll have the complete cycle for down there for our fans to listen to.
You've been together a long time, so what are some of the goals that you have in terms of recording or performing in the future?
You know, 23 years of playing together has definitely brought some interesting opportunities and some wonderful concerts and touring. I mean, most of our focus is on continuing to play great music and really try to make a connection with our audience, getting out there and really sharing all of these amazing things that we get to work on every day with people. I definitely think exposure to this great music of Schubert and Beethoven allows people to really appreciate it more. So we're going to keep doing that. We're going to keep being on the road. We're going to keep playing meaningful concerts and try to bring our best to every place that we go. Recording wise, you know, we're exploring some new programs for our 25th season. We're calling it the Archive Project, where we are basically recreating programs from the past. We're exploring the history of the touring string quartet in North America and looking at programs of three great quartets, the Kneisel Quartet, the Kolisch Quartet, blanking on the third one, Flanzali.
The Flanzali Quartet,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they programmed very differently at the turn of the century, early in the 20th century. And so we're recreating some of those programs because in a way they were our mentors. You know, they're our great grandparents in the string quartet world. And for our 25th season, we thought paying homage to that history and that tradition, all the great information that's been passed down from that time to us, would be fascinating and interesting. And who knows, we might end up recording one of those programs as well.
I noticed you've done marathon concerts with the Beethoven cycle, and I'm curious how you go about presenting these. Is there historical information provided to the audience as well? Is it interactive? Or do you feel the music speaks for itself?
Well, in the way I could say the music does speak for itself, but one of the things that we like to do with the Beethoven cycle is when we can, we love to do it within the context, a shorter time frame, maybe like a week or 10 days, so that the audience has a chance to sort of remember each previous show when they're coming to hear the next one. And we perform all of the pieces in their compositional order, which isn't exactly their numerical order, because the opus numbers don't always follow the order of his life composing them. And we tell the story, both from stage and also with the program notes we have, of Beethoven's life and how personally he developed as a young artist, for example, the Opus 18s, unknown but a virtuoso pianist, as a mature artist who was achieving fame and success as a middle-aged man, as someone who struggled, as we mentioned, with family and personal life and had a big drought in his life for composing and also with emotional connection. And then this sort of final years where he was deaf, he was in many ways isolated, but finding his consolation personally in exploring artistically what the quartet medium had to offer. And telling that story both verbally and then having the music tell that story in a way that the audience can connect to personally and individually, I think makes the Beethoven cycle as a whole come alive in a unique way, a different way than, say, playing a concert with an early, a middle, and a late piece just to show the variety of what's happening. It's a wonderful way to do it too, but we really like trying to get the audience to feel like they're following along with his life story and identifying with it, because many of his struggles personally are struggles we all go through. So the music shares his personal stamp, but also has a universal message and sometimes one of consolation that we can all really, I think, identify with.
The quartet has a residency at the University of Texas, Austin. How has having this base impacted your reach and your goals for performing and teaching?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned before that there's this great lineage of education and teachers that we had. And, you know, we feel like it's our obligation to pass on this information that really has been around for hundreds of years. We could even actually track it back to Beethoven himself as a teacher. So having a home base as a string quartet also has its advantages, which is that we feel rooted and grounded. We have a really consistent place to work and kind of woodshed, as they say, music and repertoire. It gives us our great testing ground for new music and you know, things that we're unfamiliar with. We can get them out in front of people, our students. But also, you know, teaching has a great merit in that I'm constantly learning from my students. I'm constantly having to refine my own playing to make sure that when I demonstrate something to them that I'm doing so efficiently and correctly. There's so many benefits to having this job, and the university has been so wonderful, and the city of Austin has been so great and sort of welcoming to us that we really feel like, although none of us are Texans by birth, we're here. We're Texans now. I mean, Austin is really, really our home.
Joshua Gindel and John Largis from the Miro Quartet talking with me here on 88.9 WCVE Richmond Public Radio.